everybody, and welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenues Minor League Podcast. I'm Steve Swiper, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos, Ken Levin, and Thomas Henderson. So, guys, how is it going today?
All right.
Yeah, pretty good.
Watching the refs wear blindfolds in the Chiefs-Browns games, just great, you know.
Seems to always happen. All right, well, today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, but technically it's not actually his birthday because of the way that calendars work. But today is Mark Messier's birthday, obviously one of the greatest hockey players ever. And when we think of Mark Messier, we think of 1994 and ending the curse of 1940 and everything like that. But he did have an amazing career with the Oilers, and he really was better there than he was with the Rangers. So, of these amazing players who had great careers with their first team and then got traded to other teams where they also kind of became the face of the franchise, who are we going to promote, extend, or trade? First up, there's Mike Piazza, who was the face of the Dodgers for 7 years.
Extend.
And then he came to the Mets for eight. He was a six-time All-Star, a Silver Slugger, and an MVP candidate. Next is Gary Carter, who was the face of the Expos for 12 years, and then he came to the Mets for five, and he was a four-time All-Star, Silver Slugger, and MVP candidate. And finally, we have Carlos Beltran, who I don't know if I would say was the face of the Royals necessarily, but obviously he was one of the better players that they had. And then he became associated with the Astros in that really crazy postseason run that he had with them in 2004. But then he came to the Mets for 7 years, and he was a five-time All-Star, Gold Glover, Silver Slugger, and MVP candidate. So Ken is already in the extend Mike Piazza boat.
Yes.
And I can't, I can't disagree, I guess.
Oh, I'm going to be sacrilegious and say extend Beltran instead, but okay.
Piazza's just kind of like one of my favorite players of all time. He's like my first favorite player, so.
That's fair.
That's why I chose that. The other two were pretty hard for me, but I think I'm going to go promote Beltran, trade Carter, just because I never saw Carter play beyond like video and stuff.
So I think I'm going to, like I said, I'm going to extend Beltran because that was the first time I was really into baseball, was that 2006 run. I was too young to really appreciate the 99 and 2000 Mets too much. I'm going to make it even worse now too. I'm going to promote Carter because he at least won, and Piazza, they never did. So to me, that's the trade. Oh boy, I'm gonna.
I just want to check the war real quick.
I enjoy good catchers, but I'm top tier center fielders are like my favorite.
Can't argue. I mean, Beltran was of all these guys. You know, Piazza was with the Mets for 8 years. Beltran is seven, so he did have the second longest tenure of all these guys. And obviously, you know, everyone here is a Silver Slugger and MVP candidate, but Beltran is the only one that's also a Gold Glover.
My biggest knock against Beltran is he was never the face of the Mets.
True.
That was David Wright. Like, no matter what, Beltran was never, he never reached that pedestal.
And you could argue maybe in like 2005, 2006, before Wright really kind of came into prominence. And there was like the whole, you know, the whole Carlos and Carlos thing that they had with him and Carlos Delgado. But I definitely will agree that he was never really in the forefront for too long.
Yeah, it became Wright's team very quickly, where even with Carter, like, he was probably the captain of the 80s teams, but, like, Keith and Ron are literally the Mets announcers, and they were, like, of course, Carter, like, he passed away, so, like, he didn't really get a chance, but also he's an Expo. Like, I don't consider Carter a Met. I consider Carter an Expo. Piazza is not a Dodger, and like Piazza's a New York.
No, player. Obviously he's a Marlin.
Yeah.
he's an Oakland A if he's anything.
Ugly's considered him a Padre, so
he was good with the Padres that the one aberrant year. I saw him when he was at the Padres. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Did anyone check the WAR there? Who was actually the best?
Carter was. Let's see. This is all F WAR. Carter was the best by F WAR. 69.
Nice.
69.4. Beltran number 2, 67.9, and then Piazza 363.7.
And WAR is also weird for catchers because defense.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Let's see. Piazza 7,745 games.
It's honestly not that big of a spread. Like,
no, very tight.
If it was like a 20 WAR gap, I'd be like, okay, this dude is obviously better. But they're all pretty close. So I don't know. I just loved Carlos Beltran.
Well, yeah, it's even closer if you look at, like, per plate appearance, because Piazza had by far the fewest plate appearances out of the three, but, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot closer on the field, but to me, I think the off-the-field stuff is clearly, I think Piazza is clearly the guy for that. Like, everyone talks about, like, the whole outlier stuff was, like, the Mets were, like, good, and then they got Piazza, and they realized that they could be great. And, like, I feel like we could have this conversation about Lindor in 10 years if he does extend. Like, if Pete and Conforto stick around, like, Lindor is going to be the face of the team, even though he wasn't homegrown. And I think it's a similar situation to that, like, if we're hoping onto the future here. But, like, that's how I think of it. Like, Piazza kind of revitalized the Mets, where Beltran came and helped, and then immediately became second fiddle to David Wright. And Carter was a good player, but he was past his prime by the time.
Carter, I'm also looking at Fangraphs right now, only had two good seasons with the Mets, really.
Yeah, like he's
the most, like, overrated guy, like, ever.
Yeah, like, I don't. He's an
great
Expo.
Great player, obvious Hall of Famer, but he was an 140 Expo. WRC plus in 1985, 115 in 1986, and then was well below average every other year he was with the Mets. So
I'm sure there's also, rightly or wrong, I would argue wrongly, like, Beltran did so many great things for the Mets, but everyone's just going to remember him standing there with the bat on his shoulder in Game 7.
Kind of a tangent. I just remember being, I don't know, maybe like 13 in 2000. Well, he came over in 2005.
Uh-huh.
And that was like the coolest thing ever. For like young preteen Kenny, it's like, oh my god, how did we get Carlos Beltran? Mm-hmm. So,
with a lot of money, Well,
some clown paid him based on what he was and not what he was going to.
Oh, here we go.
Yes, that's true. Oh, the days of the snake bitten Mets.
And then he got Zach Wheeler, who was one of my favorite pitchers for the last couple of years. Like, he's always been fun, so I'm here for it.
And then Zach Wheeler got us Isaiah Green, and Isaiah Green
so
got
Carlos
us Francisco
Beltran
Lindor.
Got us Francisco Lindor. argument over.
Yep. Huh. You heard it here first.
Yeah, that definitely changes things.
This is like that weird line you can take from David Wright back to, like, Matlack or whatever, right? I forget how that one works exactly.
Yeah. Basically, all baseball players are basically like 2 degrees of separation from each other.
It's like a mitochondrial Eve somewhere.
Yeah, you can trace David Wright back to like Ty Cobb if you try.
All right. So normally this is a discussion that we have over the summer, but coronavirus has obviously fucked up a lot of shit. And one of the things that it fucked up was the international free agent signing period. Normally that is July 2nd, but this year it started on July 15th, a couple of days ago.
And at least, you know, I have a complaint about this, you know?
Yeah, sure.
It was July 2nd, so it always called it J2. Why couldn't we have at least kept a January 2nd and still had a J2? Like, come on, people.
It's a good point.
Who's in charge of this? I wish to register a complaint.
They could have done January 20th and called it J20.
No, there you go. Come on. J2.0. Yeah, there it is. J2, that's it. That's it.
Better. It's better than mine, yes.
It's actually something.
At MLB front office, hire Thomas for a marketing position. Immediately.
Do it. You won't.
It's actually something that we kind of like have to keep in mind. If they don't keep it and they go back to July 2nd, like next year, because I know when I'm just kind of glancing through pages, if I see July 2nd on a guy, I'm just like, okay, so he was probably somebody. And basically any other date, you know, the further you are from July 2nd, the less important this guy probably was. Not the case with these guys. So, you know, like 4 years from now, when we're just kind of quickly glancing the pages and we see, okay, this dude just signed in July 15th, I'm going to think like, oh, he's a nobody. But in reality, you know, these guys are not necessarily nobodies. Not the ones that other teams signed anyway.
It's an especially irrelevant point when you consider that these guys have had contracts, quote unquote, signed for like 2.5 years, if not longer. So,
if they had contracts, that would be illegal.
Yeah. Oh, let me hold on. I got to delete my crimes.xls real quick.
I hope you turned off your Wi-Fi too, because they'll find you.
Oh, shit.
Uh huh.
Did you hear that, Google?
But yeah, anyway, so Ben Badler, Intrepid Baseball America reporter, he reported a while ago that the Mets weren't going to be big spenders in the J2.0 market, and sure enough, they weren't. The strategy this year was basically to spread the money around and give out a bunch of small to moderate size bonuses rather than going with one or two big players. And they had about $5.3 million to work with. And as of 2 days from the start of the international signing period, they spent a minimum of $2.4 million in bonus with all the financial details that have been made public. And definitely they've spent more than that, because you need to also factor in all of the financial details that haven't been made public yet that'll slowly trickle in. So far, the highest bonus they've given to anybody has been to a Dominican outfielder named Yohairo Cuervas, and he got $500,000. And then all the other players who have gotten bonuses that have been publicly announced, they're all between $150,000 and $400,000 so far. Honestly, I am not a fan of this strategy.
I've actually had this discussion before.
Go ahead, Lucas.
No, this is like the Sandy special, isn't it? This is what he used to do when he was...
I mean, not really.
Isn't this Brody's class, though, if they all agreed 2 years ago?
Yeah, technically it would be a Brody.
Like,
if anything, the Mets have done well in recent years at the top end of the market. Think like Jimenez, Mauricio, Alvarez...
Mm-hmm.
Like, basically, I wonder how a new front office deals with this, because like these deals were already agreed to, like, quote unquote, like, so I wonder if, like, even if Sandy doesn't like these players or like would do something differently, his hands are tied.
Well, I mean, that's the ultimate problem, is that his hands are not tied. I mean, yes. a lot of people get hung up in the I don't know what the right word would be. The ethics of giving contracts to 16-year-old people, players, kids. I'm not hung up on that part so much. I really don't care about their age, but it's the fact that they're not getting contracts is what the problem is. Because the day before, you could just say to some kid, like, oh, yeah, we've been stringing you along for 2 years, and we're deciding to go in a separate direction. We're sorry that you're screwed, but sorry. You know? Like, there's no protection for them. Which is my bigger thing than their exact age, which is a problem in and of itself as well.
Wasn't the Sandy strategy. I think we talked about this as Brody's strategy as a complement to his draft strategy, right? Where, hey, we're punting a bunch of picks in the draft, right? and in order to sign like one or two big guys at the top. So we're going to do the opposite in the IFA market and just spread it out.
Basically, what the strategy was the last couple of years, let's go back to 2017. They go with one big guy in 2017. It was Ronnie Mauricio, who got $2.1 million in 2018. It was Francisco Alvarez, who got
like
$2.7
million guys.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of lower ticket guys like Mauricio. That was the same year Hernandez, I think, was signed. Going back a little farther, it was Jimenez and Guerrero.
2015, that was.
Yeah, and then Alvarez and Freddy Valdez. And I think there was only one in 2019. I think it was just Ramirez.
Yeah, correct. Basically, the last time the Mets have done this kind of strategy where they're really not giving any bonuses over, let's say, 500, which I'm just going to make an assumption. I mean, they could go out and, you know, give some dude $2 million, you know, next week. We don't know about, but last time they spread the money around this equally is during the 2016 to 2017 IFA period. That class was not particularly impressive.
That was also a very weird class because that was the year, if memory serves, that Boston busted their pool, the Padres busted their pool, and a few other guys just really went like apeshit in the international market. And so, like, I didn't really have a problem at the time with sitting it out because all the prices were super inflated.
That year,
like, four teams were just throwing around money.
Mm-hmm. I think it was also the Yankees, or they might have gone the year before. But that year, Sebastian Espino, shortstop, got the highest bonus, $300,000. He was kind of like a high floor, low ceiling shortstop. And, you know, he got picked up in Rule 5 draft, so he's not here anymore. So, you know, don't know if that's going to end up being, good or bad. The next highest bonus was third baseman Jose Peroza. He got a $280,000 bonus. And he's kind of like a bootleg version of Wilmer Flores. He's like a okay power over hit, but no defensive value.
He's like absurdly tiny, right?
I wouldn't say he's
man.
No. I mean, he's not like Luis Santana tiny, but he's not particularly big. He's like built, chunky.
Like 5'9", maybe?
No, bigger than that.
Okay.
Luis Santana is quote unquote 5'9", but.
Luis Santana is like 5'5".
Outfielder Ezequiel Pena, he got a $200,000 bonus and he's been released. The aforementioned Luis Santana, he got a $200,000 bonus in that draft class. First baseman Wilmy Valdez, he got $180,000. He was released. Giancarlo Soto, $150,000, and I don't really know what his status is. He hasn't played in 2 years, but he is technically active. So regardless, though, he was never really like a guy or anything like that. Wilfred Estudillo, he got $150,000. He was interesting, and now he's part of the Reds organization, so oh well. Shortstop Alexis Marquez got $135,000. He was released. Catcher Alejandro Medina, he got $115,000. He was released. Basically, the two most interesting guys are the guys that got the least amount of money, Dyson Acosta and Michael Otañez, who got less than $100,000. You add them up, and they basically, you add them up, $70,000 and $35,000, and it's $100,000, you know, so.
Quick maps.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes to show that there is not necessarily a correlation between the amount of money that a guy gets and then their career trajectory or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, Ronnie Mauricio, he got the money and he's currently a number one prospect. Francisco Alvarez, like you pay for the tools and there is definitely a certain threshold where there, I would say, you know, it pays. It's more effective, I guess, to go out and spend big on at least one guy who has those tools. And then if you want to go out crazy and get those lottery ticket guys and call it a day, cool. But
that's probably what I would do, is get one top guy and then spread the rest of it out. Unless you could finagle too, but
I don't have a particular hot take on either path, honestly.
Yeah, I don't think I'd be mad.
I generally prefer to get the elite players, you know.
See, I think that I would generally agree, like, give me the elite guy in the draft, give me the elite guy in free agency, whatever. I think that these guys are so far off, though, and the information you're working on is usually either so non-existent or just poor. I think there's an argument for quantity over quality. It's like, you're signing dudes at 16.
Very important, you know? Like, yeah, you could, you know, Franklin Barreto got the same amount of money as some of these guys. Like, you know, it doesn't look like he's going to be much. But, you know, when you hit on a guy like that,
but there are plenty of guys. There are plenty of guys who've been hit on. That came out wrong. plenty of the cheaper guys who click and still wind up as top prospects. I'm trying to rack my head for a good example right now, but
and Rafael Montero is always the go-to.
Yeah.
Henry Mejia.
I mean, if you look outside of the Mets organization, Sixto Sanchez was
That's a good one.
I don't know, like a 50K sign.
Wasn't Gary Sanchez
cheap?
My point
cheap, is, there's a limited amount of guys at the high end of the market that you have relatively good information on. You know.
My take is that the information on them isn't that good.
And then
good.
You can also sign an unlimited amount of these lower guys because they're all so cheap relative to everybody else.
I think that someone who we will talk about in a little bit is a good example of this, Robert Dominguez. He was signed for $90,000, I think, and he was generally thought of as an afterthought because at the time when most scouts were looking at him and other players of his age, he was kind of, you know, throwing a nondescript high 80s, low 90s fastball. And then you fast forward a few months and he's, I don't know if he grew or not, but whatever he did, and all of a sudden now his fastball is sitting mid 90s, touching upper 90s. And that's a very, very different player. But because he was an afterthought at the time, you know, a lot of teams spent money. They didn't have money left, whatever the case. And he gets, you know, relatively small signing bonus relative to, you know, his talent level and everything else. But, you know, so scouting is especially important. Obviously, scouting kids this young, you know, 16 and younger has present major pitfalls and issues in and of itself.
You got the randomness factor by like double from the draft. Mm-hmm. Because it's just, I would have no clue how you could figure out someone's potential 10 years later. Like,
Here's a good example, right? Like, if you look at the 2016 signing class, obviously Kevin Maiton is at the top, and that's like a historically, like, there's a whole bunch of stuff that went wrong there. Braves, et cetera, right? So let's skip past him. I'm going to skip the Cuban guys too, because that's a different market unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
Luis Almanzar, Jesus, I can't read, $4 million. Not a real notable prospect right now. Lazarito Armenteros is, that's another Cuban guy. Gabriel Rios just got traded last year. He's a pretty good prospect. Alfredo Rodriguez, another Cuban guy. Luis Garcia is a good, pretty good prospect for the Nationals. He got $1.3 million. There's a point being, there's a whole list of guys. I'm just going off like MLB's top 30. All these guys got $800,000 or higher. Plenty of them got $3 million or more. The best player in this class is probably Luis Patino, who got $130,000. I think even at the top end of this, the IFA market, your information is so inherently bad, and not even just bad, but irrelevant to the ultimate. Because like, there's this ton of shit that happens to players between 16 and 17, things can change drastically. Between 16 and 20, things can change drastically. A dude could grow 6 inches, like, in 2 months, because that's what happens.
Yep, that is literally what happened at Jalen Palmer.
Yeah, exactly. So, This is just my gut feeling. I think I'd prefer a quantity over quality approach to the IFA market.
That being said, though, if you see like present skills, you know, like presently developed skills, like Ronnie Mauricio has a very good arm, you know.
Sure.
Ronnie Mauricio is already very tall and already has a pretty good swing. I don't mind taking a big bet on something like that, where you have skills already in place, and it's just about refinement, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, those are the things that drive the cost up. You have a kid who has an arm already, okay, that's gonna, you know, that's X amount
like
of dollars.
Alvarez, you know, like, he's the bat speed's already there.
Yep.
Like,
well, here's my, I don't have a definitive counter-argument, I'm just trying to play the devil's advocate here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think a lot of the skills
is,
you wind up seeing.
It depends on the player.
Sure. But also, I think a lot of the skills you wind up seeing are speed, arm strength, ultimately defensive skills. Which is why I feel like a lot of these guys, the two words scouting, quote unquote scouting report on half of these guys is sure-handed shortstop needs to develop offensively. So if you're just paying for defensive skills, in a league that maybe devalues defense a little too much, but to a certain, like, I think it's been pretty reasonably demonstrated at this point that defense just isn't as important as everything else. So why are you paying a premium for defensive skills when the offensive skills are so hard to recognize? Like, you can see bat speed, yeah, but then, like, are you going to have any ability to recognize spin, do bat to ball, et cetera, et cetera?
It is an interesting way of looking at it. I think it's more, instead of saying you're paying for defense, I think it's almost saying like you're paying for floor. Like the guys.
Yeah, that's what it is, I think.
I would
argue
you're paying for athletic ability, you know?
Paying for athletic ability in a sport where athletic ability is less important.
You need some.
Yeah, but yeah, you don't want to be Seth Beer, obviously, but.
Paying for athletic ability in a world where Pablo Sandoval has like 3 World Series rings.
He's good at athletic actions. He's just not athletic.
don't disparage Panda.
I apologize.
Your business has gone through a lot this year. Pivots, restructuring, maybe even downsizing. You've got enough challenges when it comes to running your business. Hiring shouldn't be one of them. When you go to ZipRecruiter.com/Vox, you're one step closer to crossing find the perfect new hire off your new year to-do list. ZipRecruiter can help managers like you post to hundreds of job sites with one click and makes finding the perfect match for your open role a breeze with powerful matching tools and automated application invites so you can personally ask potential candidates to apply without opening a new email draft. It's no wonder that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. You can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Vox. That's ZipRecruiter.com/VOX. Let ZipRecruiter take finding qualified candidates off your plate so you can focus on growing your business. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Vox. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Well, before we get to our, you know, the meat and potatoes here, the top prospect list, and we are just talking about international baseball right before, you know, the break here. There's a little winter league news. La Liga Baseball Profesional, Roberto Clemente, the Puerto Rican Winter League, they just concluded their regular season. They're in the playoffs now. And last week, the Puerto Rican Committee of Sports Journalists unanimously selected the 2020 to 2021 MVP. And that individual, Lucas will be very happy, is Genushui Fargas.
Ah, yes.
The Farg.
How many bases did he steal? Do we know?
He appeared in 16 games in total for Los Criollos de Caguas, and he hit 349, 434, 635 with 4 homers, 7 stolen bases, and 10 tries. and 6 walks to 17 strikeouts.
That actually wasn't as extreme as I was hoping.
Hey, 70% success rate. Yeah, so that's sure. That's within the margin of actually being an effective base stealer. So that's your guy.
You give him a look in spring training.
Yeah, I mean,
look, if the Mets want to sign George Springer and then say and kind of punt on the backup center field position, I'm fine with giving Fargus a bench spot. That'll be fun.
It'll
be dumb fun, but it'll be fun. Don't sign Jackie Bradley Jr. and put Fargus on the bench, though. That'd be bad.
Yeah.
Not Galaxy Brain, but Wilpon Brain would be not signing Springer and then making Fargus the center fielder.
Make him the starting center fielder.
Yes, yes.
You know, who's like a center fielder who's like 38 and clearly not good anymore?
There's a lot of
That's the guy they would sign and then make the backup Fargus.
Kevin Pillar or something?
Rajai Davis.
Pillar is extremely well pawned. Yeah.
Rajai Davis was that guy a year ago. Yes.
Let's see. Skull. Center fielders.
Has to be 38 or older, Lucas.
Brett Gardner's 37.
Oh god, I always thought they were going to.
That works. Yeah,
I think you could fudge that.
Former Yankee can handle New York.
Grit
kind of a face
plays the game the leader. Right way.
Yes.
Kind of sucks. It all fits.
At Steve Cohen, Stephen A. Cohen, too. Do not. Do this.
I say this is somebody who enjoyed Brett Gardner for years, but no.
Yeah, not now.
Not when you need a real center fielder.
No.
At Mets, sign George Springer.
Yes, please. All right, well, last week we were rudely interrupted by a major, possibly franchise-chasing trade, but things are back to normal this week. So, we are resuming our 2021 Top 25 Prospects review. That is a tongue twister. I did not realize. Jeez. Mm-hmm. 2021 Top 25. Okay. So, we reviewed 25 to 21 last time. 25 was right-handed reliever Riley Gilliam. 24 was right-handed starter Jordani Ventura. 23 was catcher Andy Rodriguez. 22 was outfielder Stanley Consuegra. And 21 was outfielder Adrian Hernandez. So we're going to get, we're going to jump right back into things and pick up where we left off. And that is with number 20 on the list. And that is right-handed starting pitcher, Sam McWilliams. And he literally wasn't in the organization like 2 months ago. And yet here he is on our top prospect list. So, that on one hand shows how thin the Mets minor league system is, and on the other hand, it actually also shows like this is a pretty shrewd move, a pretty good move. And obviously his signing kind of got some press because he got a contract worth about $750,000 despite never actually having pitched in the majors before, which is atypical. But basically, he was who was he drafted by? He was drafted by the Phillies. Then he was traded to the Arizona Diamondbacks in exchange for Jeremy Hellickson. And he started blossoming in Arizona. And by 2018, he was kind of like a borderline top prospect in their system. Then in May 2018, he was traded to the Tampa Bay Rays. And a year later, he was selected by the Royals in the Rule 5 draft, but they returned him back to Tampa Bay because he was pretty bad in spring training. And, you know, after the 2020 season, which is weird, here he is. But he's a big athletic guy, big athletic pitcher, 6'7", 230 pounds. So that's the kind of guy that can soak up a lot of innings. Pretty simple delivery, you know, nothing, no major red flags or anything like that. He has a low to mid 90s fastball, really a low to mid 90s sinker, and he pairs that with a slider and a changeup, both of which kind of flash being average or better. The slider is the more consistent of the two, which is usually how these things go. Mm. Really it's just about maintaining his command, because he kind of can get a little, I don't want to say wild at times, but, you know, he's not a pinpoint control type of guy.
He has your classic big picture problems.
Mm-hmm, exactly. But, I mean, all things considered, it's for less than $1 million cash, no strings attached. No strings attached. That's a pretty good addition to the system.
Yeah, this is something the old Mets would have never done. They would have never done something this smart.
They would have seen this as a waste of $700,000.
Yep.
Yeah. For sure. For sure.
Mm. All right, next up on the list is 19, and that is right-handed starter Dyson Acosta. And he was signed, as we were discussing before, as a international free agent for $70,000 in 2016. And he kind of came into his own at the end of the 2018 season when he was with Kingsport, and then the 2019 season when he was with Brooklyn, and then Columbia. And he's 22 now, which is a little less exciting than last year when he was 21, you know, but given this lost season and everything like that, he has a pretty effortless delivery and low 90s fastball, tops out about 94 or so. The story on him for a while now has been that he is kind of tall and lanky, so, you know, hey, he might put on some additional growth, and that'll help the fastball and the durability and everything like that. That's been the story for like 3 years now. So, you know, and of course he was kind of MIA last year like everybody else. So maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But at this point, you know, he's 22, turning 23 next season. So just going to want to see some, you know, returns, for lack of a better word on that. But in addition to the fastball, he has a big breaking curveball. Very big fan of it. And then same thing, like basically everybody has a developing changeup that's kind of flashes being okay, but it needs to be thrown more. But overall, he is, like we've kind of brought up 2 weeks ago with Jordani Ventura, the kind of prototypical starter's build. That's what you have with Acosta.
So one thing I particularly like about Acosta is I think he's got a pen fallback in a way that a lot of other guys don't, simply because he's already got one very good secondary.
Mm-hmm.
So if the velocity doesn't come in general, maybe it'll come in short bursts. I could see him being a pretty good reliever at some point.
Yeah.
I agree. He's at least someone to keep an eye on for that reason, like more so than other.
I think he's got more of a big league future than a lot of these guys his general tier.
I agree with that for sure. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if they shift him to the pen for development reasons and he just is solid.
Yeah, and he's up at like 23. And
I wonder if the lost season, I wonder how, if this would be kind of a trend with a lot of these guys who lost a season due to COVID, if a higher percentage of them get shifted to being relievers sooner because, you know, you lost that year of development time and that makes becoming a starter harder. But like you said, he definitely has a better chance here.
Well, there's also the fact that the lower minors, anyway, have lost two entire teams. So, you know, there's only five. You can only have five, six, maybe seven starters if you want to stretch it like real crazy on a team. So a lot of guys that they're keeping that they can end up retaining, but, you know, might have been kind of like the fringy end of the rotation starter on, let's say, St. Lucie last year, if we had a season, might find themselves in the bullpen now just because there are better guys that need, you know, those starting reps.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that.
It's a very dog-eat-dog world, unfortunately, in baseball now. All right. Number 18 on our prospect list is outfielder Alexander Ramirez. He was basically their top get in the 2019 and 2020 international signing class, and they signed him for $2.05 million. and he's never actually, you know, appeared in a professional game because of everything going on. But when he was signed, he was 6'3", 170 pounds. Maybe he's put on some good muscle. Hopefully he has. But there was a lot of potential with bat. He was showed line drive power, and a really good understanding of the strike zone for somebody that was, you know, that age. So that's always a really good thing to see at someone that, from someone so young. It at the time though, it really kind of only was line drive power. But obviously he's very physical, you know, 6'3", 170 pounds. So that would suggest some growth, and with growth usually comes in-game power. And then defensively, he was a solid center fielder. He had speed, tons of speed, plus speed. And that obviously lends itself to playing center field very well. But same thing, just very, very little professional experience. So one of those things that, like, you know, you just want to see him get into games and learn how to be a center fielder as opposed to just kind of using his athleticism to wing it.
He's pretty exciting for me.
Yeah.
He's someone who I could see with a full season and playing, like actually playing and stuff. Could be a guy we talk about a lot more highly of next year. What'd you say, Ken?
He could look a lot like Ronnie Mauricio prospect-wise.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, he also might look a lot like Gregory Guerrero in a couple years, but
well,
I don't know. I think the good path is a little more likely.
Yep.
From the cut of his gym, you know?
He has a lot of tools that I could see that, like a lot of what you described, Steve, is, like, good floor tools where, like, he'll at the very least keep going in the system and keep getting better and better each year. And if the rest of it develops, then there's really something good there.
Let's hope.
Fingers crossed.
Nothing else we could really do.
I mean, yeah, of course. It's
just so hard to find, like, all these guys we would have been talking about as guys we were excited to watch last year. Now it's like, yeah, well, we didn't see anything last year, so
yeah.
We're still excited.
We still know nothing.
Yeah, it was a pretty weird thought experiment doing this list, just because you have to factor in, like, okay, this guy is another year older.
And who knows what they
still
can
know?
Do.
Yeah, like, has he been playing Call of Duty for 6 months, or has he been like turning into a machine for 6 months? Don't know. I guess we'll find out in spring training.
Spring training can be really fun for that. Like, when everyone is finally there and playing again, we're gonna be like, oh, what? There's at least gonna be three or four dudes who are gonna be totally surprised by.
Some of them are going to look like James Harden in Houston, and some of them are going to look like James Harden in Brooklyn.
Next up on the list at 17 is right-handed pitcher Robert Dominguez, who we touched on before. He was an international free agent in eligible to sign in 2018, but the stuff was just kind of, you know, eh, so he flew under the radar. And he had an additional year of physical growth and development and coaching and all that other kind of stuff. So the next year, when he was eligible to sign in 2019, all of a sudden he is, you know, a very different pitcher. And the Mets were able to snag him for a few thousand dollars, which is, according to many people more knowledgeable about this than me, basically the biggest steal of the 2019 to 2020 international draft class. So I like to hear that the Mets were making good moves and getting the steals instead of the ones being ripped off and making stupid moves.
It's a strange feeling as a Mets fan, you know?
I know.
Almost never happens.
I know. But similar to Alexander Ramirez, he hasn't gotten into any actual games yet. So we're just basically basing this on the reports prior to him signing, but, you know,
he is really interested to see where his command is at with that fastball.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of guys can,
it's like,
can throw really
everything
hard.
We heard with Michael Ohtani is, and, you know, it turns out that he can throw that hard because he has literally no idea where it's going.
Exactly. You know, over the summer, there's him. Over the summer, I remember the Mets signed two guys, Sammy Tavares and Richard Brito, and everyone's like, oh my God, these guys can throw 100. That's awesome. It's like, if you're two, you know, if these two guys are on the older side and they're signing in, you know, June, they're, you know, they're kind of leftovers. It doesn't matter that they can throw 100 because there's obviously a reason why they were passed over beforehand. But, you know, hopefully everything goes right with Dominguez. He's a good frame for pitching, 6'4", 200 pounds. So that's the kind of thing he could stay as a starter. He throws a curve and a changeup. The curve flashes being average or better. And the changeup, again, you know, it's still developing. So good prototypical right-handed starter build. Good base. Nowhere but up to go from there. And speaking of nowhere but up to go, the last guy on our list that we will discuss today is number 16, Harold Gonzalez. And he was a guy that has been around for forever, it seems. He was signed.
How many years in a row is this? Like,
but he has steadily basically gotten better and better and better every single year that he's been in the system. And I'm not saying that they're major improvements. They are kind of marginal improvements, but they are improvements nonetheless. He was signed out of Dominican in 2014, and I guess he really put himself on the map in, you know, as a guy in 2015 with Kingsport, and then, like, as a guy with a capital G in Brooklyn the next year.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. With the exception of his, let's see, what year was it? 2018 season, when he went to the Brumble Ponies midseason and he was just terrible, you know, with a 7.79 ERA. With the exception of that, he's been okay to good at every stop that he's made at over the minor league ladder. And he's just one of those guys that, like, the margin of error is so extremely thin, but he's made it to the top and he's knocking on the door of the major leagues.
I really hope this is the year he gets there.
Yep.
I mean, on the one hand, you hope they sign enough starting pitching that Harold never gets a start.
Yeah.
On the other hand, let Harold start.
Yeah, at some point I want to see him make the majors.
I'm kind of afraid just because, you know, fastball just kind of sits around 90 if you're lucky. And if he's really feeling good, maybe he rears back and throws 91, you know, but
it doesn't need to be pretty, Steve. I just want him to get there.
Yeah, that's true.
I agree.
Let him start the hangover game the day after they clinch the NL East, you know?
Wow, yes. I like that. Sunday lineup, of course. But basically, you know, not a great fastball, a bunch of secondary pitches, curve, slider, changeup. Nothing jumps out at you, but they're all, like, solid pitches. And, you know, he's a guy that is just the sum of the parts is better than any individual part. And I feel like we all wax poetic about Harold just because, you know, he's been around so long and just everything about
him.
He's
a friend of the pod.
Of course. Him and
Ringo. And it's a great story. Like,
Harold, come on the show.
Dudes like that normally don't get that far.
Yeah, that's also, you know, this is a major league environment where if you're not throwing, let's say, 95, 96, you just kind of scoff at. So
yeah, he's a rarity in today's game, even in the minor league level, because, like you said, the Mets were signing dudes who were, like, 17 throwing 100. Like, it's people don't throw that soft anymore, and have any type of success at the professional level, not even discounting the major league level, because that's a whole different story. But like, and he's good in the minors. Like, he's good every year, and it's wild that he's good every year, and it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you could expect, okay, Brooklyn, obviously, like, every pitcher in creation has been good in Brooklyn, but, and the places that the Mets have had, you know, their teams, Columbia, he was still around, when Savannah was in the
system.
But Savannah, Columbia, St. Lucie, they all kind of skew towards, you know, pitching. I think Binghamton really is like first point in which, right? I think it slightly favors hitters, but not overly much. And then obviously, Las Vegas and last season Syracuse with the International League ball helps favors hitters a lot, but he's looked sharp against hitters. So.
I mean, I really wish that the time to get him in the majors was last year.
Yes.
I don't know why he never got a chance.
It'll happen.
Because Ariel Jurado needed to be...
Right,
get him going.
Got to trade other podcast interest Stephen Valines for a bad starting pitcher instead of just using the possibly better starting pitcher already in the org.
And then DFA him in December.
Yep.
Guys,
it's so Mets. It's just so Mets.
It's the old Mets can't hurt us anymore.
Exactly.
We have Francisco Lindor.
Jeff Wilpon is real. He can't hurt you, guys.
We have Francisco Lindor now.
That is very true.
Straight. I'm like that. I'm like the Wolverine meme, gently stroking a picture of Stephen, tearfully holding a picture of Stephen Valines.
Well, I guess that segues nicely to our closing segment, the Wilponry of the Week, because we all know how deep the Wilponry hurts us all.
Uh-huh.
So I think that easily... And I think this is almost a textbook definition of Wilponry. I think it goes to Joe Biden, who basically expressly campaigned during the special elections in Georgia for $2,000 stimulus checks. And now he's changing his tune and saying, no, I almost meant $1,400 stimulus checks, because the $600 ones that you got a couple of months ago and $1,400 equals $2,000. That literally sounds like something that the Wilpons would say.
I mean, that's what they did for years.
That literally is what they did.
What? You said you wanted a first baseman. You didn't say he had to be good.
That is the political equivalent of, like, a returning player who is injured is just like getting a draft.
Exactly. Yeah, it was Zach Wheeler's our big midseason addition or whatever the line is.
Jed Lowry is the big trade.
There it is.
Trade deadline acquisition.
Oh, Jed Lowry.
Jed Lowry is a $1,400 check. He got many of those for doing that much. Fucking Wilpons.
How long will it take the fan base to recover from the mental trauma of 2 decades of Wilponry?
Never. It'll never happen.
No.
How much therapy do we have to pay for to work through this?
That thought is gone. Yeah. But basically, in like 50 years, we're all going to be, you know, saying to our grandchildren, going to come sitting on our lap, and it's like, let me tell you a story about the Wilpons.
About those putzes.
Better yet, it will be around the campfire telling horror stories. Let me tell you about when the Wilpons owned the Mets.
It was this fella.
Yikes. Now it's bothering me. What the hell is his name? Donald Grant. I kept thinking Frank Cashin, but no, I'm Donald Grant. The same way how, you know, Mets fans of a certain age are scarred by him and the whole Tom Seaver trade. We are a generation that's scarred by just inept Wilpon ownership.
Yep.
All right. Well, if anyone has any questions, comments, or whatever, you can send us an email at our email address from complextoqueens@gmail.com. You could follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Sipa. Lucas is at ElVlahus343. Ken is at KenLavin91. And Thomas is at SaidMetSeasonSZN. Subscribe to the podcast where you get your podcast from. Rate and review it. And, of course, thank you for listening. And we'll be back next week with the next part of our prospect list countdown. So until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.